Good morning, everyone. I'll call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Today is Wednesday. We have four bills that are on our agenda today, three that are public hearings and possible work sessions, then we are coming back to another work session bill. Because of the way we're going to use council today as to having one of our assistants, interns helping, we're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 234 and ask council if you can give us an overview on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 234 allows service of the appeal petition on a land use board of appeals, on the Land Use Board of Appeals, LUBA, and other parties by first-class mail. We have received statements. We have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact, and there's no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And let's see, we have one person signed up on 234, Chris Crean. Morning, Chris. How are you doing?
Morning, Chair Prusansky, members of the committee. My name is Chris Crane. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you today on behalf of the Oregon State Bar in favor of Senate Bill 234. The committee staff is handing out my testimony right now, so I won't read it to you. I'll just summarize. The bill addresses a discrepancy between two statutes dealing with appeals to the Court of Appeals. If you take an appeal to the Court of Appeals from the local trial court in Lane County or Washington County or Klamath County, you can serve the other parties. You file it with the Court of Appeals and you serve the other parties by first-class mail or certified mail or registered mail at your option. The statute for appealing to the Court of Appeals from LUBA says that you have to serve the other parties by registered or certified mail. It doesn't say first-class mail. It also has a provision in that statute that says, and, oh, by the way, you have to comply with the requirements of this statute, and these requirements are jurisdictional. And don't you know that somebody appealed a LUBA decision to the Court of Appeals and served the other parties by first-class mail? There's no question the other parties got the appeal petition, but they didn't serve it by registered or certified mail, and the Court of Appeals dismissed the appeal. They said, it's jurisdictional. We don't have jurisdiction to hear this appeal because you didn't serve the other parties by registered or certified mail. The Supreme Court actually took that review of that decision and upheld the Court of Appeals, said, statute's clear, it's jurisdictional, you didn't serve the other parties by first-class mail, you lose. We can't, the committee's, I chair the Land Use Legislation Committee, I'm on the Executive Committee on the Real Estate and Land Use section. We can't think of a policy basis for that distinction. It amounts to a malpractice trap for the unwary practitioner. If you practice a lot of land use, you're probably aware of that requirement, but if you don't, you're not going to be aware of it. And the statute in Chapter 19, 19.260, for all other appeals from the circuit courts, allows you to serve by first class. And so a lot of people who practice in the trial courts would appeal the LUBA decision in the same way they appeal all other decisions, and they would lose on that basis. So we don't think there's any policy reason for requiring an appeal from LUBA to be served by registered or certified mail. So we would add first class mailing option to the statute, and that's what Senate Bill 234 does. And I would ask for your support and a pass recommendation and move the bill to the floor.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Chris, I guess the one thing I will ask, just to put on the record, was there, through the work group, any, review of why we may have had a separate policy as to a LUBA appeal as compared to what the general statute governs for appeals from the circuit court?
No. We did have that discussion. As I say, nobody could come up with a policy basis. Anecdotally, and in the interest of full disclosure, I think I wrote that statute when I was with legislative counsel, and I was a new lawyer, not really familiar with the process for appealing decisions. It was probably me and John Chandler downstairs in legislative counsel's office, and we made it up. And we got close, but not quite close enough.
So we're writing a wrong from someone told John.
This is my mea culpa and chance to fix something that I probably broke 10 years ago.
Fair enough. Sorry to bring it up. Not really. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 234 and open a work session on Senate Bill 234. If there's any questions, and just for one of our members coming in, just let everyone know, at this point we're looking at making a change in the statutes that govern LUBA appeals and how they are perfected, and requiring, instead of just requiring it to be done through registered or certified mail, that it could be done as any other type of appeal coming out of the circuit court by using the system that's used for those appeals, which is allowing also first-class mail to be used, and it can be any of the three. So with that, is there any discussion?
Entertain a motion.
I will entertain a motion.
I move Senate Bill 234 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bonamici moves Senate Bill 234 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Now, is there any discussion? Any objection? And that is on the objection side?
That's the objection side, Mr.
Chair. All right. So if the record can reflect, Senator Boquist is objecting, will be a no vote. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 234. And at this point, what I'm going to do, because we're going to
be... You need a carrier for the bill.
You
need a carrier. I'm volunteering, but I
thought you just volunteered, Senator.
Not if he's going to ask questions.
No, I'm not asking any questions.
No.
I'd be happy to carry it if you need a carrier.
Looking at what else we got today.
They're trunking Social Security.
Yeah. I'll ask Senator Bonamici, why don't you carry this one?
Be happy to.
Okay. And so what we're going to do is we're going to jump on the agenda. We're going to go down to the work session because we're going to change counsel after this one. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 240. And, Council, if you could bring us up to speed where we're at on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 240, we heard on Inauguration Day on 120, and it's the bill that limits the Social Security numbers and driver's license numbers to the final four digits in several different documents, like writs of garnishment and judgment documents. It has no revenue impact, and we've received a statement. It does have a minimal fiscal that we just received today, and that minimal means it's less than $10,000, and I've talked to legislative fiscal office, and it's substantially less than $10,000. There is no amendment on this bill. Just to refresh your recollection, Pat Wade testified and submitted testimony from Mark Comstock on behalf of the debtor-creditor section.
All right, thank you. So, is there any discussion at this point? I guess I'm going to go ahead and entertain a motion to move Senate Bill 240 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
So moved.
Senator Dingfelder moves Senate Bill 240 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion based on the summary that we received from Council?
All carried, Mr. Chair.
This is an easy one.
Still object to the emergency clauses on these things scattered willy-nilly, but I won't vote against the bill. But it's I think that we're, and you're going to hear this a lot, I suppose, but I think we are misusing our emergency clauses dreadfully.
All right, and I appreciate that. And I guess what I would say in, quote unquote, the defense in this particular case, and I think there may be other ones that we will both be in agreement, is that since this does deal with personal security, I prefer as an individual to give individuals that protection sooner than later. And this is hopefully will be one of few bills that we will have that will bring into line what we've been working on over the last 4 to 6 years, and that is to update our statutes to give individuals more protection of their personal identification numbers, such as Social Security numbers or driver's license. Any other discussion? Any objection to the motion that's before us? Not seeing or hearing any. So move to the floor with the due pass recommendation. And Senator Boquist will be our carrier on this one. And with that, what I'm going to do is go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 56. I'm going to allow the transfer of councils.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This is my name.
Not in name dropper.
Thank you.
All right. So at this point, we're going to go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 56, and Council, if you'll give us an overview of what we have before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Senate Bill 56 requires a complainant to sign a complaint alleging unlawful discrimination before submitting it to the Bureau of Labor and Industries, Civil Rights Division for Administrative Investigation. Fiscal and revenue statements have been issued. There is no impact, and there are have been no amendments.
All right, thank you. We have one person that looks, well, actually two people are signed up for testimony today. Bob Esbrook and then Amy Clare.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy Clare. I'm the administrator of the Civil Rights Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Senate Bill 56 is a pretty straightforward bill. It just requires that all complainants sign their complaints that are filed with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm not going to read my statement to you, and I've talked with most members of the committee except for the chair, so we couldn't get to you yesterday. I apologize for that.
Bob caught me on the way.
He did. Okay. At present, an attorney can file a complaint with the Bureau of Labor and Industries on behalf of a complainant and sign for that complainant. The problem arises is when we are investigating this complaint as duly filed with the EEOC. We have a contract with the EEOC to investigate claims that are covered under both state and federal law, and the EEOC will not accept a complaint that is not signed by the complainant. So this would just make the standard in Oregon be consistent with federal law. And I urge your support.
All right, thank you. And Mr. Esterbrook, did you have any other statements?
I don't have anything to add to that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to ask if there's anyone else in the room today who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 56. Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 56. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 56, and the chair will entertain a motion regarding the movement for Senate Bill 56.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
With the due pass.
Yes.
Senator Broquist moves Senate Bill 56 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any other discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senate Bill 56 will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And the chair will take this one just to kind of balance this out. And what we're going to do now is go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 57. And Council, if you can give us an overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 57 provides that an employer commits unlawful employment practice if employer discriminates against employee or a job applicant based on the fact that members of the employee's or applicant's family works or has worked for the employer, even though the employer has mixed motives for the discrimination, applies only to conduct occurring after the effective date of the bill. Fiscal and revenue impacts statements have been issued. There is no impact, and there have been no amendments.
All right, thank you. So Amy and Bob, you're both on the list as proponents, and so I'm not sure who's going to testify, but go forward.
Senator, I'll go ahead and let Amy speak to this since it is her division.
Again, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This was
And just for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Amy Clare. I'm the administrator of the Civil Rights Division. We introduced this legislation because family relationship is the only protected class that has the qualifier of solely, which precludes us from doing a mixed motive analysis on these types of cases, meaning there may be more than one reason why someone was terminated from employment, but because of the word solely in there, that has to be the only reason. So it's a higher burden for the complainant to meet to get a cause case. We thought this was a technical fix, and in meeting with Senator Whitsitt and some other members, and then also learning from Associate Oregon Industries that there's opposition to this measure, we're willing to do more research on it before we try to get this through a work session.
Okay, thank you. So basically, just for the record, what you're attempting to do is allow for other causes or reasons for the discrimination to be able to be on the table, and currently under the rules or the statutes, we have a situation that if there's any other reason besides an action of the family member, then you're prohibited from moving on that itself because it could be influenced by the other factors?
Correct. But I can give an example. Most types of cases we have involve a mixed motive analysis. One that comes to mind that we see frequently are individuals in the workplace that complain about workplace safety. It's an OSHA-related complaint. We've had cases where the OSHA-related complaint was a significant factor in the termination of an employee, but there were some other legal reasons why the employer terminated the employee. Maybe they had missed 3 days of work, or maybe they just didn't like them. But if, you know, that we were able to apply a mixed motive in that analysis, we can't do that with family relationship. It has to be the sole reason.
Okay. All right. Any questions? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Clare, there is, we talked about this, obviously, and in removing, I have two concerns. I think that removing the term solely will make it considerably easier to qualify for an unlawful practice for the complainant, and also we're still trying to find why the legislature in their wisdom put the word solely in that one law and not in all the other ones. They probably had a reason. Have you been able to just to go through the legislative history and find that?
Well, I'm going to let Bob speak to, again, Amy Clare, Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt. I'm going to be real honest. I've gone through piles of papers like this thick, going back to the late 1970s, and the more I read, the more confused I got. And I'm going to let Bob speak to the nepotism issue.
Well,
ID yourself, just for the record.
Of course, Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, Bob Esterbrook from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. The understanding that we have from the legislative history we've been able to review is that in creating this statute, there was concern about, there was a desire that this statute not be prohibitive of nepotism. So that would be a separate issue than what we're dealing with here, that this would be specifically tied to the employee's family relationships rather than an employer's family relationships. And the use of the word solely, I think, makes it clear that it is not an issue with nepotism, but what that also does is interfere with the analysis that we would normally do from the employee's point of view. And so to our way of looking at this, it was a way to solve a problem that was perceived at the time, but it has had, unfortunately, a consequence that we're not as able to do our job of investigating these complaints as well as we would like to.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, sure. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Clare and Mr. Esterbrook, can you give any examples of cases that you've investigated under the statute where you've had a problem because of the word solely in there? I just think it would help to put it in the context of some of the work that you've done to date.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I don't have an example right with me, unfortunately. We have a case that's open that I can't discuss because it's not subject to public disclosure, where the investigator spoke with me last night and said that this is one such case, but unfortunately it's still an open case, so I can't discuss it.
Thank you.
So basically what I'm hearing in this particular situation is that you have family members who may be held to, let's say, a different standard as to what they are able to prove as to them having some type of unlawful employment practice solely because they are a relative or family member of the employer as compared to someone who's not related to them.
Correct.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much for your testimony. J.L. Wilson.
Record, J.L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industries. I'm not going to formally testify in opposition. I can't represent that. We haven't adopted a formal position on the bill yet, but the bill was distributed. The feedback was swift and vehement, and I want to keep an open mind on the issue and work with Bully. It could very well be that we don't have the whole picture. Maybe we're missing something, but maybe we agree to disagree, but I at least want to keep an open mind. But these were the concerns that came back to us. and these were quotes from various members who commented, by changing the threshold, it would create more confusion in the courts and allow more lawsuits to progress that otherwise wouldn't or shouldn't. The third bullet point came from a construction contractor. Anytime an employer is deciding to hire, promote, or compensate, or terminate a family member, it would need to be able to prove that the family status played no part in the decision, and this would almost always be a factual issue that in many cases would be difficult to prove. Which leads to the next point that someone raised. If you're talking about a new question of fact where none existed before, questions of fact invariably lead to lawsuits. One quote that we got, this is going to force me to prove a negative, that a family relationship did not prompt an adverse employment action, which is an impossible task for us. It raises a question of fact, and any time you do that, we're going to trial. And it just muddies the current situation. One example that was given to us of a corporate counsel that may be illustrative of our at least our initial point of view on this issue. Say you have the owner of a company hires his brother, and the brother steals from the company, the brother's terminated. As it stands now, the termination would not result in unfair employment action because there was another reason he was terminated, for stealing. Under Senate Bill 57, because it was the owner's brother who stole from the company, his relationship would be considered to determine if the family relationship was one of the factors considered in making the discharge decision. Would it result in an unfair employment practice? Maybe, maybe not. But the one thing that was for certain is that there would be a lawsuit in order to determine that fact. So those are the initial concerns that we have going into the bill. Like I mentioned, we're happy to keep an open mind and get clarification from Boley, but at this point there is a lot of initial concern on the bill.
Thank you. Question? JL, you heard the question I asked as to the standard or status for a family member versus a non-family member. I'd hope that your review will take that into consideration, because what I'm hearing on the record, it seems like there's a disparity. Just because you're employed by a family member, you have certain rights that are, let's say, reduced or negated as compared to if you were working for a non-family member. And so if you could look into that from the perspective, the chair would appreciate it.
Happy to do that.
Any other questions or comments?
Chair Brzezinski, I think you probably hit the nail right on the head there, and many small businesses are very family-oriented, and quite frankly, I'm not at all certain that the Fair Labor Laws should extend to whether you hire a family member or don't, whether you continue to keep your wife employed or not. That's getting micromanaging the labor force to the point where you could even dissuade people from going into business. There's a point where fair labor practices are useful, and there are a point where they are harmful, and I think in this case it goes beyond that.
Thank you. Any other comments? JL, thank you very much for your testimony. And so let me ask if there's anyone else here today that wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 57. Not seeing anyone coming forward, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 57. And at this point, my understanding that the proponents and the Association of Oregon Industries will continue to look at this, and if there is, say, some resolution or decision to move forward, the proponents will have the, let's say, call it the burden to get back with council to let them know that they want to move forward. And I do want to make certain that if you choose to do so, that you make certain that the Oregon Association of Industries knows of your intent. With that, is there anything else council needs to cover today? What you know of?
No, Mr. Chair, we don't have anything else.
All right. With that, it looks like we've concluded our business for today. We're scheduled for tomorrow at 8:30, and so we'll close our committee hearings and work sessions from today. Thank you.